Welcome to CRE Radio with Howard Klein. Our focus is commercial real estate, exploring vital questions, confronting commercial landlords, property and asset managers, investors, brokers, tenants, and anyone providing services to the industry. Your host is Howard Klein. His commercial real estate practice over 35 years has concentrated on broker, leasing, and property management issues. CRE Radio broadcasts are presented with the sole intent of educating listeners. Howard and his guests are specifically not offering legal advice. If you need legal advice, consult your own counsel. CRE Radio is available live and downloadable anytime at creradio.com. Call in during the live show with your comments or questions, 619-393-6492. Then press 1 to be placed in queue. And now, here's Howard Klein.
Hello, this is Howard Klein, and it's so true to everything that seems to go on. I'm scrambling a bit. I just had Sam Shandan on the phone, and we lost him just as the show started. So my trusty engineer is going to be calling him and getting him back on the line. Sam and I were talking about a bunch of these things having to do with the fiscal cliff. Dr. Sam Shandan is the president of Shandan Economics, and he's from Wharton, and he's an adjunct professor there too. So we'll go ahead and kind of give you a little bit of a summary as we're working on getting Sam back into the loop. And so why don't we go ahead and talk a little bit about, let's see. Okay, Sam wants to talk about, and I think that this would be appropriate. We've got another caller on the line, and why don't we do that? Hello, I've got a caller on the line, and who is that? Okay, so let's get back to our radio show. Sam wants to talk a little bit about whether or not the fiscal cliff itself is a bluster, and I agree with him because a lot of the research that I've been doing over the last
Howard, Sam Shandan here.
Oh, Sam, I
apologize
that
for the disconnection.
No, that's right. You're on the air, Sam, and I was just punting, actually. and I was talking about some of the things that we're going to talk about. I think that we ought to go right into the issue, since I was talking about, is the bluster effect of this fiscal cliff. And why don't you talk about, if you don't mind, what the fiscal cliff is and to what extent it's a bluster. And this can be a fairly extensive conversation, so I'm going to hand it off to you.
Okay, well, first, thank you for the invitation to join you again. I'm really delighted to be here. The discussion around the fiscal cliff has certainly taken on a life of its own over the course of a couple of months. And I think in the eyes of readers, the general press, the general news, perhaps more so even just the last couple of days or weeks, what I think is important to remember here is that this is a situation of our own creation. Some time ago, the last time we, so to speak, kicked the can down the road on this issue of, well, we've got a structural deficit at the federal level, where that just means that we're spending too much relative to the revenue that we bring in, and we've got to close that gap. Well, the last time we agreed in Washington, or our representatives in Washington, I should say, agreed to delay addressing this issue directly, they wanted to put in some kind of cost that ultimately, if we didn't address this, if we didn't find a way to compromise and work together, that there would be severe consequences. And so they by design, made the consequences of actually working together quite severe. We've come up to that point. And I think what's disappointing for a lot of people is that the timing of this is no small. It's a calendar that we set. And so is this something that we could have anticipated? Is it something that could have months ago rather than at the 11th hour? Absolutely. Did we choose? Was a specific choice made amongst our representatives in Washington, irrespective of the exact circumstances and the exact reasons for disagreement? Ultimately, it is a consequence of choices made in Washington that right before we are positioned to slide over the fiscal cliff, but, we are still trying to work these things out. And in terms of what it actually means, then, it's obviously become a topic unto itself, and there is a lot of bluster around it. I should say that there's this general sense that the more progress is actually being made, the less we're going to hear about it. But I mean that if behind the scenes, the negotiations are actually leading to some positive outcomes, we're actually getting somewhere with those discussions, then the folks in Washington, their respective parties who might spend some time on television, on the news, positioning, are less likely to do so because they're in that room actually getting something done. So a bit of a lull in the chatter isn't something that that we should take badly. What does this mean for us then? Well, there are a couple of things that are going to happen beginning on January 1st. If we don't come to some kind of agreement, there will be increases in personal income tax rates. There are going to be, at the same time as we've got increases in personal income tax rates, increases in the payroll taxes that we pay. And that's going to be something that across the board, anyone who has wage or salary income right there is going to see their costs increase by 2%. Apart from the impact on earned income, on wage income, there is a scheduled increase in the capital gains tax rate and in the tax rate on dividends. So
Sam, can I interrupt you for a second? Because these are the specifics that we'll be getting into and how these things will affect commercial real property. But I'd like to talk a little bit about that bluster thing, which is how you addressed it. Because I'm trying to figure out if the world's going to end, not according to the Mayan calendar, or is the world going to end on December 21st, or is it going to end on January 1st of 2013? So let's leave out the Mayan calendar, and let's talk a little bit about if no deal is done, what not the specifics of what's going to happen, but is this the end of the world for our economy, or is it going to affect certain people?
I think it's a great thing for the question, Howard, in part because, from the chatter in the press and in Washington, I think it's difficult for us sometimes to then take a step back and say, what are we really talking about here? How serious an issue is this? And I think that it's safe to say the world will not come to an end on January 1st. I think that in terms of the consequences of not coming to an agreement, it means that the economy will perform very weakly in the early part of 2013. We'll see some disappointing numbers in terms of net job creation. We'll see some very disappointing numbers in terms of the growth rate of the economy, in terms of consumer activity. All of that is going to then have a negative impact on how consumers feel, how businesses feel. Is it the case that we are going to see very long negative consequences from what ultimately is are having to face down the possibility of austerity? And by that I mean that what this comes down to is they're going to see lower spending by government and higher tax payments by individuals and households January 1st. Yes, that will slow things down. And I don't understate the fact that there is a distributional issue here. There are some families that are going to beat this more than others. There are going to be some individuals who will have been working hard to find new work, to reengage with the workforce, for whom that goal of finding new employment is going to get a little bit harder. And for each of those individuals, for each of those individual families, this is a very real issue that will be very much. When we look at it in the big picture, We're talking about an economy that slows down, and then one that a little bit later begins to recover from the initial shock of that of our having gone over. The best comparison point we have in terms of trying to get a sense is to, in part, look at what is happening with some of our counterparts in the European Eurozone.
Before you get to that, I was reading a blog post here from a gentleman by the name of Chris Kirk. And Chris wrote, he says, if Democrats and Republicans in Congress don't come up with a tax plan, they can both swallow. The U.S. U.S. will plummet over the fiscal cliff, meaning that taxpayers will be slammed with a series of automatic tax hikes and tax credit reductions, and that we'd slip into another recession. The fiscal cliff metaphor doesn't exactly reflect the situation, according to Chris. I think the problem is it's Chris and Cliff, and I'm getting a little tongue-tied here, that the situation may be intentionally alarmist, but alternatives such as fiscal slope and fiscal garden seem more likely to draw laughter than serious consideration. And what he says is to stick to the metaphor then, some taxpayers will fall farther than others. For instance, he goes on to say that single taxpayers will fall farther than married taxpayers. Married taxpayers with children will fall farther than married people without without children. I'm already trying to get rid of my children. No, it's not already. I've been doing that a long time. Let's see what else. He says that poor people will fare much worse than richer people if we fall off the fiscal cliff. What do you say to that? Because I thought that was a little bit different.
I think that's actually a fair assessment on Chris's part. What we'll see is that the marginal tax rate, how much you're actually paying out in taxes from different sources of income, the increase in payments by relatively wealthier households or individuals will be bigger than it is for for more income constrained households. So, if you're relatively low income, if you're a working household, the impact of the fiscal cliff in terms of how many actual dollars you have to pay to the government, in terms of much smaller than what it is for wealthier families and households. But you've got to then put that in the context of, well, how important are those individual dollars? And I think what we see is that a family of four, two parents, two kids, both working, but having to send their kids to school, having to feed a family of four, having to provide for some level of entertainment, when you take a little bit away, whether it's 2% or 3% or 4%, these are families that may not have a sizable discretionary pot to spend out of. If I imagine the household that's earning $40,000-$45,000, after they've paid rent or their mortgage, after they've paid for all of the other necessities of life, how much do they have left after that to then be able to do some of the other things that they'd like, to be able to buy new clothes, go on holidays, do something extra for their kids at Christmas? It's in that situation where we see that those extra dollars, there just aren't a lot of them. And in part, there aren't a lot of them because incomes haven't been growing very quickly the last couple of years. The labor market's been pretty soft. So when you increase taxes on this group, those discretionary dollars that you're cutting into, it can make a big difference for those families. On the other hand, when we look at relatively wealthier households, we can debate all day issues around fairness. How should we structure tax systems? Should the rich pay more or less? What we do know is that when we look at the hard economic evidence, very wealthy households, even if you tax them a little bit more than we're taxing them today, does that affect their consumption behavior? Does that mean that they're having to cut back on some things that they otherwise wouldn't have cut back on? Well, the kinds of changes in tax rates that we're talking about for the wealthiest households, we shouldn't really anticipate. We don't really have a lot of hard evidence that would lead us to believe that, you know, those consumption patterns would change in a way that, you know, they their life would be materially impacted.
Sam, why don't we take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit about how what we were talking about really affects people in commercial real estate too, because there may be both different sectors in commercial real estate that may have more of an impact on, and different types of investors having a different impact. So why don't we take a little break now and hear from some of our sponsors.
Go mobile with the analyst. When the deal changes, and you know it will, be ready whenever, wherever to update property analyses with the analyst. Multi-page reports in seconds sent straight from your mobile device to your client's email. Environmental summaries delivered right to your iPhone or iPad in as little as 10 minutes. Free from your desk at last with the analyst. Log on to creradio.com for Howard's comments, his one-on-one with developer Todd Kuhlman, and links to the analyst. If you're a retail tenant, you really should belong to the NRTA. They're an organization of the tenants, by the tenants, and for the tenants. Whether you manage a large portfolio or just a mom and pop, the National Retail Tenants Association is on your side. NRTA exists to protect retail tenants everywhere and to make sure landlord billings are correct. Don't wait for your next statement of CAM charges to arrive. Log on to retailtenants.org. That's retailtenants.org. Find out more today. This is Commercial Real Estate Radio with Howard Klein. If you have a question or a comment for Howard or his guests, please call 619-393-6492. That's area 619-393-6492. Then press 1 to be placed in queue.
Welcome back to CRE Radio. We're interviewing Dr. Sam Shandan from Shandan Economics. And we were just talking about a number of different things, but whether or not the fiscal cliff is such a cliff, or maybe people are blustering a bit. And why don't we kind of shift a little bit? Because we've been just talking about generically and how the fiscal cliff may affect various households. What about commercial real estate? Are there any particular categories of commercial real property that the cliff can affect, Sam?
Sure, and I think probably the best way for me to frame this is in thinking about what we really need in commercial real estate today. If we're looking at the sectors, if we're looking at the grid types and saying, you know what, what's been missing so far in this recovery? And, you know, if I could juice the engine just a little bit, what would I want to see happen in the economy in 2013 that could, you know, help move commercial real estate forward? It's not interest rates. It's not borrowing costs. If you're in a big market, it's a little bit easier to get a mortgage, a new financing today than it was a year ago. I think in a lot of markets, the thing that we've been missing is just a stronger underlying set of economic trends, whether that be in terms of growth, whether that be in terms of job creation, whether that be in terms of household income and spending. And here I think is where sort of the biggest challenge is going to be from the fiscal cliff for commercial real estate. There are all sorts of differences that will arise from our taxing investments more heavily today. In as much as this has the real potential And I think our expectation is that going over the cliff will result in a slowdown in economic activity. The reader's blog that you met suggested that there was the potential for a recession. It's certainly possible that we could see it. Sort of when you think about sort of your rule of thumb definition of recession, two consecutive quarters of contraction in economic activity, all of those are very real possibilities. And that I think is troubling because it is sort of that economic engine that has been the missing link for a lot of us in commerce state in driving these outcomes. The differences that we might observe across property types, a more difficult economic environment, one where lenders, other participants are still a little bit more conservative because job creation isn't as strong. One of the oddities of all of this, of course, is that that may have the effect of slowing or reversing some of the recent gains we've been seeing in housing. There are lots of folks who, current prices and levels of affordability would love to become single-family owners, but who have not been able to because it's been difficult to qualify for a mortgage. Part of what is allowing for it to improve of late is that it's gotten a little bit easier to qualify for that mortgage. That situation, we could see ourselves taking a step back there. And the oddity then, it might actually help to sustain some of the strong outcomes that the apartment sector and rental demand. The other sectors, office in particular, are probably the places where most cautious view then. It's not to say that that there'll be tailwinds across the board. It's not all positives for apartments if we go over the fiscal cliff, not by any means. But those balance weighs in favor of headwinds and drag on improvements and performance when we look at office and retail in particular. It's highly dependent on office using job growth, which has been a weak area of the jobs recovery. More important, retail. We have a complicated for the retail sector. There are some aspects of retail that assets with strong credit quality tenants, bank branches, high-frequented restaurants, three-anchored community shopping centers. So the necessities are in play, and those assets, in a flight to quality, have been real favorites. There have been some regional malls that have seen indications of recovery. You look at how some of the regions are performing and what they're reporting on their large regional malls, and occupancy rates are high. And in part, that's because they're apparel, people started to come back, particularly over the last year. I think, Howard, one of the things that we've seen is that begins to improve. Consumers start to feel a lot better where they sit about their savings, about their long-term. Housing has a lot to do with that. And so it's no surprise that in spite of all of these, all the buffet that we have in the broader economy and in the the policy environment, that over the last year, consumer confidence up until a couple of weeks ago had really picked up. By the end of November was at its highest levels for the recession. That was really helping to move forward, was helping them to spend and grow their spending at a slightly faster rate than their incomes were growing. And that can help to trigger a virtuous cycle. Unfortunately, it's going to be very, very difficult for consumers to sustain that increase in spend. In fact, we would expect to see that consumers would cut back, not only because they'd have less discretionary dollars to spend, but also because their confidence will have been weakened by what's happened. Not only their confidence in the recovery, but it's their confidence in the long-term growth trajectory. In fact, I can say that the degree of dysfunction that we're observing is acute, that is going to affect people's perceptions about how they feel about the economy, how they feel about their job security over the long run, and spend a little bit less. That's going to hurt retail. It's going to be one of the channels through which going over really hurt the economy.
Sure. Sam, it strikes me that retail, if the general economy slows down, you'll have a lot of cuts in the federal government. That'll also affect, if the federal government's not spending money, then you're probably going to have a further contraction in state governments, which is not something that I've seen really abated anyhow. So you'll have more unemployment, as you say, but people aren't going to have as much money. So I think you'll first see that in retail, and then you're going to see it in manufacturing.
Mm-hmm. You'll also, you know, one of the areas of industrial, for example, that has been that has performed fairly well have been logistics. Part of the move in some segments of retail to internet sales, and I think what we have to keep in the back of our head here is that different kinds of retail goods have seen different levels of substitution into internet sales, meaning that we're all buying a lot of our reading material and our electronics online. We're not necessarily buying our groceries online, and so different kinds of retail have been in different ways. But one of the spillover effects of our moving to make so many a larger share of our purchases online have been that logistics have as a result a demand for logistics space, logistics hubs. In part just because there's so many more packages to move around the country. In some senses, that's actually then reinforced with warehouse distribution spaces. When Amazon, for example, is going to be opening and is in the process of opening more localized or regionalized distribution hubs in different parts of the country, that's a leading indicator of a broader trend where, although we may not be going into the store, there are goods and services that need moved around, and until they get to our, they're going to occupy some space somewhere. It's just not on a retail store shelf.
Sam, now, what about the classes of investors, say institutional investors versus mom and pops? How would the fiscal cliff generally affect these type of different classes of investors?
I think they do affect them in very, very different ways. What we've seen over the course, if we look back at the early state recovery, the first investors to come back to commercial real estate were institutional. And in part because there's no yield, there's no return from investing in treasuries. You may be risk averse. 2009 and 2010, you don't have the luxury of being in the thing that is lowest in risk and has the best risk out, because as a matter of policy, pushed the return on that investment into negative territory. You can't buy treasuries and actually walk away with a little bit more money at the end of the day. That means you've got to take on a little. So large institutional investors, pension funds, where did they? They're not going to take on too much or undue risk, and a lot of them then focus their attention on, and they need to focus their attention on, buying core commercial real estate assets. In the biggest markets and the gateways for the large trophies, it's an apartment, that meant a lot of capital flowing in and strong demand for those assets. It's during a period of sort of this unusual uncertainty, we're not sure where the economy's those trophy assets, in some cases, you might think of them almost as they played the role of reserve currency in commercial real estate. And the valuations have really rebounded. We have an investment in New York City today that really pegs a new peak in nations for the apartment sector. That's a 70-story plus building in Manhattan, fantastic architecturally, and no less so in terms of the valuation that's been assigned by its latest transaction. It's a little bit of a different scenario for relatively smaller investors that might be looking at small cap or mid cap, in part because these investors are far more dependent on availability of credit. They need to be able to get mortgages. They need to be able to get mortgages through banks, through CMBS, commercial mortgage-backed securities, the conduit lenders. And the assets that they're ultimately then going to invest in are ones that may have a strong performance trajectory with them. They're going to perform well. They're in great locations, but they're not as liquid. They're not in the biggest. The folks who ultimately we need to be ready to make the mortgages to support those investments, they're not ready to be in those markets.
So
for the smaller investor, it gets
tighter. It's the haves and the have-nots. Those people with capital or ready access to capital will not be negatively affected by any of this, is my guess.
I don't want to say that. I wouldn't go so far as saying they wouldn't be negatively affected, but this comes back to, I think, one of your early points, which is that exactly what this means for you, exactly how you internalize it, and how deep a cliff are you falling off of. It's very different depending on who you are, what your kind of access to capital you have.
Well, yeah, it seems to me that for those people with money, it simply comes down to a recalculation of your investment strategy. Okay, we're going to be paying, instead of a certain capital gains tax, we're going to be paying X amount of dollars more, which we'll talk about. And the internal investors may have to pay more money in tax. So the actual return is going to have to be adjusted. And in that case, it just seems to me it will drive down prices a little bit more, so that people will be buying at a lower price in order to get a better return on their property. And it just still means that the people with the money will be able to make those deals. So I still see that there'll be transactions. We'll be in the same kind of mode that we're in. Now, you're the expert. Tell me I'm wrong.
What I think we can reasonably expect to see is that, we go over let's work on the assumption that we go over the fiscal, that all of this positioning, all of this brinksmanship ultimately backfires on folks in Washington, the economy is growing more slowly. We have this new shock that means that, folks who over the course of the last year have been a little bit more ready to take on some risk, been a little bit more ready to look at a broader set of assets or investments, again, on the lending side as well as, on the investment side, they retreat. They say, a little bit, the world looks a little scarier, it looks a little riskier. We were making good progress, but we had back. And so they retreat a little bit. And so spillovers into secondary markets in terms of investment flows, in terms of, banks starting to engage again, we take a step back there as well. And we start to see that, at least for a little while, investment begins to concentrate again in just those biggest markets in a way that, is favorable to, the largest classes of investors.
Great. So we've got to hear from some of the people who pay our bills around here. So why don't we take this little break, and when we come back, I actually have a tweet, and I will find out what that tweet is. It's a question, and we'll come back in a second. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
What's next for commercial real estate and retail marketing? Pop-up retail, and it's here now. PopUpInsider.com is the premier online resource for owners to advertise and fill properties for temporary use. PopUpInsider.com is where merchants and brands shop for temporary locations. See for yourself. Go to PopUpInsider.com, create your own account, market your empty spaces, or view available locations for your business. All on one convenient site. PopUpInsider.com. If you need anything with your company logo on it, you need Monogram Magic. T-shirts, ball caps, polo shirts, anything. Monogram Magic does it beautifully, does it right, and does it right on time. For over 20 years, Monogram Magic has produced corporate apparel your people will be proud to wear. Large orders or small, it's all about attention to detail. See for yourself. Here's the website, logostolife.com. That's LOGOS, the number 2, then LIFE.com. Logostolife.com.
Here's an exciting new tool for brokers and investors, RateBlend. RateBlend is a powerful online rent calculator that's quick and easy to use. Print and send detailed, effective rent analyses with a single click. RateBlend is easy to read, so what does your spreadsheet mean goes away. As a web app, RateBlend is accessible from your computer or any mobile device. Log on to creradio.com for Howard's comments, his one-on-one with developer Andrew Bermudez, and links to RateBlend. Try it today.
This is Commercial Real Estate Radio with Howard Klein. If you have a question or a comment for Howard or his guest, please call 619-393-6492. That's area 619-393-6492. Then press 1 to be placed in queue.
With Dr. Sam Shandan, and we have a tweet here. Mike, why don't you tell us what the tweet is?
Howard, actually, we have a two-part tweet from Catherine. Catherine is a CPA up in Santa Barbara area, and she asks this. Part of the debate over the fiscal cliff, of course, centers on reforming the tax system, and one proposal would base taxes on consumption rather than on income. So her question is, do you think that such a change is likely? And I guess the follow-up would be, how do you think it might impact the commercial real estate industry?
Well, Sam, it's all yours.
That is a great question. You know, and I think, you know, Catherine's question, an immediate point that I think we need to make, which is that, you know, I think in some venues, in some discussions, it's almost been described if are getting resolution around the fiscal next couple of weeks is the end to this issue, is if we put it to bed and, you know, can move on. And it's a thing of the kind. You know, Catherine's raising, you know, the very important point, which we have a much more fundamental issue that we're trying to deal with, which, you know, we've got a structural deficit, and it's entirely unsustainable. We've got to find a way to deal with it. Addressing the fiscal cliff is really just about this question of, well, you know, the right time to increase taxes and cut spending. Is it, you know, 'cause we have some discretion over time. I mean, maybe we do it a little later. Maybe we do it differently. And I, you know, part of the, you know, real discussion right now in Washington, there are differences of opinion on sides of the aisle around, well, be tax cuts. What kinds of tax cuts should it be? Increases or decreases in spending? How should those be positioned? Either way, we're really just going to find a solution. Very meaningful steps to address the basic structural issue with our deficits is something that, you know, that has to happen next year, the year after.
Sam, can I ask why?
There is what's that?
Why?
Why do we have to deal with it?
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, it sounds very basic. Sounds like a stupid question, and, you know, it probably is, but I think it's a real basic question, and a lot of people
not at all.
You know, we got to take care of this. Why?
I think there are a I think that it's not a terrible question at all. I think, you know, given how at the federal level we are taking budgetary policy, and by that I mean, you know, how we've chosen to collect revenue, how we've chosen to spend, since that we've allowed ourselves to run. There's clearly a cadre of folks who believe that, who are asking the same question. Well, you know, what's the problem? Why not? What we do know is that the more, the bigger that deficit, the larger the pool of accumulated. You know, how do we finance the gap? We borrow. And
Why do we have to borrow? Why can't we just print money?
Well, we do print a little bit of money. Actually, we print quite a bit. We can borrow domestically. We can, you know, borrow cross border by getting people to invest in bonds. There are lots of ways in which we can move money into the system, And I'll, you know, without going into an academic lecture on monetary policy, Howard, I'll tell you that we're pretty much pulling all of those levers. The difficulty on the piece of this where we're borrowing is that ultimately, I mean, we have to, you know, this is borrowing that we have to pay back. And that means that, you know, every time we borrow a little bit more, we have, you know, larger, you know, interest payments that need to be made. And like any situation,
I'm going to be the lawyer again, not the economist, which of course I'm not. But why do we have to pay back money that we borrow? I have to do it as a person. Because if I don't pay money back, people aren't going to give me, you know, people aren't going to loan me money. I won't be able to get credit. I'm going to have to deal on a cash by cash basis, you know, and if I don't have the cash, I don't eat food.
The only reason we're able to borrow as cheaply as we do and as we can is because of the belief and, you know, I think for a lot of people, the certainty that the U.S. government will make good on its obligations. So there's, you know, when we academic textbook, when we look at how, you know, the global bond market functions, the reason the U.S. Treasury is the risk-free asset over which anything else has a slight risk premium is because when we look around that landscape, it's the one asset where we say there is no chance of default. And so, you know, with there being no risk, our cost of borrowing is very, very low. We don't have to compensate our lenders
for risk. Let's assume for the moment that we have to pay back what we borrow as a country. If we don't pay it back, if the debt just continues to increase, because it seems to just continue to increase anyhow.
Yes, it does.
You know, if we don't pay it back, if it becomes $30 trillion, $40 trillion in the next 4 or 5 years, how does that affect Joe the plumber? How is that going to affect commercial real estate?
Well, the immediate effect that it got, you know, it's playing out right now, and it's going to be a much, much bigger way once interest rates actually start to rise. It's not just a question of paying this money back. It's that until we pay it back, we've got to make interest payments. And what you're going to see is that we've built up that every larger share of the federal budget goes making those interest payments. You could say, well, that's okay. We'll just raise a little bit more revenue. But there you come back to the base issue. So if we've got to make larger interest payments, there are two things we can do. Either tax people more to raise the money to make those payments, or we can cut spending in some other areas. And so for every dollar of tax revenue that we collect at our level, we're spending less on things like Social Security, on things like education, and instead we're on interest payments. So there's this what we refer to as a crowding out. We have to spend so much more money just making interest payments, less money for everything else. Now,
that's a little bit like someone living on their credit cards and paying nearly 30% interest. Yeah, at first it doesn't seem like such a bad idea, but
the difference for us at the United level, you know, why have we been able to misbehave at the federal level of the United States? You know, because there's this mechanism, you know, for everyone else. If you're an individual, if you're, you know, a young person in college, you've got credit scores, you've got how much you borrowed relative to your income helped on a loan. You know, that's going to come back to haunt you. There are all sorts of mechanisms in the market designed to make sure that you behave. We don't really have those mechanisms at the federal level. And the best way that I can sort of illustrate that is with, you know, remember a couple of years ago, one of the major rating agencies downgraded the credit quality of the United States, right? So, you know, we're not anymore. There's a little bit of risk there. We're going to lower your credit rating. Well, what? That happened on a Friday. How did that play out in the market? Well, the way it played out was as follows. Credit rating of the United States, that means that all of a sudden everything else in the world looks riskier. If the United States is riskier, if the Treasury is riskier, then the whole world is a little riskier. If the world is riskier, what do? You push all of your capital into the safest thing around. And that's where the funny part comes in. We damage treasury, everything looks riskier, so capital markets run into the risk-free asset. The lowest risk asset in the market is still the U.S. Treasury. And Friday, we have a downgrade of the U.S. government. On Monday, we see our credit costs actually fall. It gets cheaper for the U.S. government. So we've got this unusual situation. If we really, at the federal level, running these bills up on a credit card and paying a 30% interest rate, then we would have found bond earlier. But because interest rates are so low, because we're not in the facing the consequent higher borrowing, the pressure to immediately address the issue just isn't there. You look at countries where it's different. Greece is an example of a country where that became unsustainable, and the bond market turned on them and said, we're not going to lend you, your risk is high, to sell your bonds, pay very, very high interest rates, the traded discount. We're not going to end up in that situation in the United States. We're fundamentally positioned differently. But over time, it will get a lot more expensive for us to service the debt, and that means less money for everything or more taxes.
So like each individual, we have to cut our spending and or increase our revenue, which is the fiscal cliff. And that's what all the negotiations are about. We need to take another break, Sam. And when we come back, I'd like to talk about the Federal Open Market Committee. And then ultimately, I'd like to get to the specific things that will happen, such as the effect on long-term capital gains, et cetera, if we don't reach the fiscal cliff. And then we'll talk a little bit about, if we don't reach the fiscal cliff, how's this going to affect everybody? So why don't we take another break, and we'll be back shortly.
Here's an exciting new tool for brokers and investors, RateBlend. RateBlend is a powerful online rent calculator that's quick and easy to use. Print and send detailed, effective rent analyses with a single click. RateBlend is easy to read, so what does your spreadsheet mean goes away. As a web app, RateBlend is accessible from your computer or any mobile device. Log on to creradio.com for Howard's comments, his one-on-one with developer Andrew Bermudez, and links to RateBlend. Try it today.
Techniques Marketing can help you do more business with your biggest clients. We've developed exciting ways to increase your revenue streams with your key accounts, way beyond mere trial and error. And we've done it for some of the biggest companies in America. If you're happy with your numbers, great. If not, we should talk. Techniques Marketing, TECH, that's the tech, NIQUES, there you've got your Neeks, TechniquesMarketing.com.
Manage a shopping center? Always looking for new ideas? Tactics. Tactics Magazine is the idea magazine for shopping center marketing directors all over the world. Exciting promotions, gift with purchase programs, and full-blown ad campaigns. Every edition of Tactics is packed with features, ideas, and news you can use to get the word out and grow your numbers. How can you manage a shopping center without your tactics? Log on to tacticsmagazine.com. Today would be good. TacticsMagazine.com.
This is Commercial Real Estate Radio with Howard Klein. If you have a question or a comment for Howard or his guest, please call 619-393-6492. That's area 619-393-6492. Then press 1 to be placed in queue.
Radio. We're here with Dr. Sam Shandan. So, Sam, Just before we did the show, you and I were talking about the Federal Open Market Committee, which met yesterday and today, and that there were some significant decisions and actions taken by them, all of which may affect not only the commercial real estate, but perhaps everything that's happening with and the negotiations relating to the fiscal cliff. So why don't you talk about that a bit?
Sure. So the FOMC, as you pointed out, had their final meeting of the year. And this has made the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, voting members of the FOMC, Arjuram, the presidencies of the regional Federal Reserve Banks. New York is a voting member, and it rotates around the other members. Essentially, make all of these choices, adopt all of these policies to monetary policy, interest rates. For the last couple of years where we've seen things or heard about things, quantitative easing, where we've heard about Operation Twist, being that Chairman Bernanke has worked to keep interest rates. It's through this channel, this decision-making body, the FOMC. And today's meeting, we were at an important juncture because one of the key programs that out of the FOMC, Operation Twist, where they've been selling short-term these on the Fed's balance sheet and buying longer-term ones to push down those long-term interest rates, that program's being down. And we wanted to see, well, are they something to take its place, or is one of these major sources of intervention that is working to keep interest rates low, is it going to dissipate and disappear? The expectation has been that the FOMC would adopt a new round of asset purchases, and indeed that is what they have indicated coming out of today's meeting. And so what we can expect to see once we go into the next couple of months is the interest rates are going to remain low, in particular going to remain low both for short and long-term interest rates. They're going to remain low if you're a residential, if you're buying a single, your mortgage rates that are available to you are going to remain low, provided, of course, qualified for that mortgage. The way that they're doing this is that they're buying bonds in the market. They're, they've got this asset purchase program. They're going to be spending in total about $85 billion. I know that going into the downturn, up until about 2000, these kinds of numbers would seem very, very large. I want to assure you that even now in 2012, these are very, very big numbers. We're talking about a significant Fed's balance sheet, but one that will play some role in helping to keep interest low. I think for commercial real estate, that is critical. And there's some good and there's some bad here. Is that cap rates stay low. It means that in costs, when you want to finance or refinance, those stay low. But for a lot of banks and other lenders out there that have a legacy pool, they were lending in 06, they've got all this distress as well as maturing mortgages. They've got this great option that they can take advantage of, which is that if we're just having trouble, they can just move them into a low interest rate. And that has been one of the main ways in which we've actually modified mortgages over the last couple of years. It hasn't been write-downs of principal. There's a lot of benefits to this low interest rate environment for commercial real estate. There are also some ways in which we're very careful. Very, very low interest rates mean that we're going to borrow cheaply, that we can borrow aggressively for assets, and that sometimes we're going to make investments, we're going to make loans, where it's going to make all the sense in the world, and the borrowing cost is 3.5%, or when the cap rate is 4 or 5%. But one day, these rates are going to be higher. You're buying a property and you're taking out a 5-year mortgage at 3.5%, everything may work just fine. But in 5 years, the interest rate isn't 3.5%, it's 6.5%, 7.5%. You have to have some very, very strong growth in property level income and NOI and rents to be able to really be able to hold the value in that property, given that interest rates are just a lot higher. So there's a double edge to this sword. It's not one that I think the market is being particularly careful about. Suggestion or my thought process here is that when investors are going into the market, word of caution, your deal may work when you could borrow at 3.5%. Make sure that it still works, even if your borrowing costs are maybe 4%, 4.5%. And if you find that if it's a little bit higher, it would be very hard for the deal to work. That may be a warning sign for you. That may be a bit of a red flag that you want to pay attention to. Right now, to medium term, what we know is that the Fed's going to keep on working to keep those rates low. They did, and this is the other major today, they changed the way in which going to signal or decide how and when they're going to raise rate. And that's a bit of a generalization, but up to now has been, over the last year or so, been signaling to the market the weight or the time period over which it might raise rates or allow rates to rise, given some dates. So we're going to keep rates low until mid-2014. We're going to keep mid-2015. They've changed that a little bit. What they've said now is that, they're going to continue to work with variable supportive monetary policy, keeping them low, and that's going to be pretty much the status quo until employment falls below 6.5% or inflation rises above 2.5%. So now we've got some concrete sense of, okay, well, how much does the economy have to improve before the Fed really eases off on its gap? And that is, from a policy perspective, in terms of how the Fed guides its decision criteria, that's actually a pretty big change. It gives us pretty measures of economic activity, of employment, to say, okay, depending on the employment market's going to improve, I have now an idea rates are going to start to go up.
Why don't we, for a moment, take a slight switch now, not a very good segue, and talk about another industry sector, which would be the housing industry. Now, you and I talked a little bit about the mortgage interest rate deduction. That doesn't come to an end as a result of the fiscal cliff. Why is that part of the conversation now?
Thanks for bringing us back to that. That actually back to Catherine's question, which I don't think I did a good job of actually answering.
Actually you didn't, but don't worry about it because I kind of steered you away.
What we know is that as she pointed out, we've got this very fundamental issue that we've got to address in the long run, and that means we're going to see over the next couple of years. We don't really have much choice about it. We're going to see over the next. A very difficult period of soul searching around exactly how we structure public finance. What do we tax? How do we? The reason I don't think that we're going to see a significant increase or shift towards consumption, which I think was part of the question, is because consumption taxes, sales generally state local level. And we don't really see that at the federal level. The federal taxes that we're working with and talking about and that are up for negotiation in the fiscal cliff are things like taxes, dividend, capital gains. Political will, would it, would sort of significant support behind the idea of the adoption, let's say, a federal value add tax of that, like we have in a number of our other Western industrialized countries, be difficult to actually get any momentum or support kind of program. What I think we are likely to see is that there are going to be some changes to our marginal tax. But probably more importantly, there are a whole set of dividends and subsidies in, we call them bills in some cases, in the tax system that mean that whatever the tax rate is on our income, we're actually paying something less than that. And we're going to start to see that, as a matter of course, we're going to have to really evaluate the appropriateness of each of these different deductions, loopholes, adjustments. One of the big ones is the deduction for mortgage interest. And I think that what we have to respect is that because the mortgage interest deduction is a big chunk of money, and because having to really evaluate all of these different programs and loopholes and deductions sides with a much larger debate as relates to, well, what's the government's role regarding single-family housing? should we be subsidizing home ownership? Emergence of those two things means that there's going to be a fairly vigorous debate around whether or not for the long term or for some segment, some income earners, we either cap the mortgage interest deduction for single family housing. I wouldn't expect abruptly. That would derail the housing recovery. But over time, it would be probably naive to think that the mortgage interest deduction would remain in play the way that we have come to know it and take advantage of it over the course of generations.
Well, there are a couple of options in that respect. And, of course, this strikes home. I'm very middle class. You know, I have a very nice house. But in Southern California, the cost of homes are exorbitant, as they are in New York. And if you start talking about, let's say you capped your mortgage interest deduction at $1 million, which sounds outrageously high to some people in certain parts of the country, wouldn't that have a huge impact on the housing market, construction, the economy as a whole in any of those markets? Because I mean, the federal government, they're talking about raising taxes to wealthy individuals who earn more than $250,000 a year. That's not wealthy in Southern California.
Well,
so,
or in Manhattan. I think there's folks are into these issues. They're on the single family housing side, do expect a very vigorous debate when this comes up, because there are very, very strong vested interest groups in Washington, related to representing home builders, realtors, representing buyers, that are not going to stand for their voices not being heard of this. I think there's a clear recognition that any abrupt changes and even any change at all, is going to have some impact on single family housing outcomes. What I suggest, imagine the potential, the scenario. We don't get rid of mortgage interest deduction altogether. We say it's going to get phased out or it's going to taper off. Depending on how large your – so very, very large mortgages may not be able to qualify. For high-income earners, our ability to take advantage of the deduction ultimately gets capped. It's true that how far your income goes, depending on whether you live on the coast, if you live in Southern California versus if you, live in the Midwest, real differences in costs of living and how far it goes. That means that, when we have, a federal tax rate, and it's $200,000, you're in the same marginal tax bracket no matter where you're located, that's not by any means system. Not a lot of good alternatives. It's probably the best option that we've got. That can actually practically enforce, that we can execute on. It does mean there's going to be some places, if you want to buy a one-bedroom apartment in Manhattan, you're going to make a much more significant investment than you do if you're in almost any other part of the country. It does act to home ownership in a way that plays out differently in differences. What I suggest is that the vast majority of Americans, when we're looking at home ownership costs, we're looking at home prices that are, for a home buyer, $150,000, $200,000, $300,000. These are going to be the home buyers that are the target of changes in tax policy as relates to the mortgage. And I think that if it does come into form of a cap on deductions, which is something that I think Governor Romney, when he was a candidate for the presidency, was advocating, so we're talking about something that's going to impact high income earners more than your first-time home buyer or your average American family.
Well, I don't know. I honestly fear it. And what I fear is that, and again, I think I have this sense that the fiscal cliff is not so much about an economic impact on our society as a whole. But the economic impact of certain financial classes of people. And you've, during the campaign, both candidates were talking a lot about where for the middle class. And I would think that that is your vast majority of people. But I see that shrinking. And my concern is putting so much pressure on the middle class. If you start putting a mortgage interest deductions, you're basically going to create a disincentive to owning homes. And you're simply going to have a wealthier class being landlords to a lower class. And we're going to go in reverse from what I've seen, what has gone on for the last 60 years.
Well, it's I think it's part of this larger secular change that may be going on in terms of how the government's role in supporting housing. And deduction, I think for a lot of people, is thought of so much as, you know, if we get rid of it, we're creating a disincentive, maybe from the other perspective, that by having the deduction in place, we're creating an potentially inappropriate incentive. We're encouraging homeownership in a way that, you know, part of why we had some problems in the housing market. Now, not that that's correct analysis, but I just want to give you where some of the opinions and ideas being out there. What I will tell you is this, that I think you're right, there are it's not as if the debate about all of these issues is taking place in an environment of careful, rational, well-thought-out possibilities, options for, restructure things, how we might think about things, how different things impact. Quite the contrary. It's happening in a highly politicized environment where sometimes, rational decision making. And, I think, that ultimately ended up hurting us all. And we see that very clearly with the fiscal cliff, whether or not they come to in the next couple of weeks, whether we go off the fiscal cliff, whether, they come back in January and solve it retroactively. The fact is that it has introduced an enormous level of uncertainty for businesses, for households, as we come closer and closer to this deadline. And for many businesses, for many families, that means that they have attended to assertively. There are businesses that might have hired, that have chosen not to hire, or have chosen to delay, or making other important investments that can enhance the productive capacity of our economy, because this is hanging over our head. So it's a disappointment, I think, because irrespective of which way it goes, the fact that we have not been able to work together to find a resolution that ultimately is one that is going to be, characterized compromise, where no one's going to get everything they want, that we haven't been able to. It doesn't really matter whether you're middle class, upper class, where you sit on the income spectrum. All of us are ultimately impacted negatively by what's going on today.
Sure, I think that's where the majority of the frustration in the American public is. not that I would know, but it seems to me that most people agree that we need to cut back on expenses. We need to stop spending as much money. Democrats, too. And most people think that we need to increase revenue. The argument is how to do it and who's going to get hurt and who's going to benefit. And that's really what it's all about. And then it comes down to, speaking as a novice in economics, everybody guessing. It's like everybody's guessing. It's like, well, we think that if we do this, this is how it's going to affect everybody. And that seems to be the predominant, at least from my two eyes. Before we close up the show, I would like to hit on some of the specific ramifications. We do know that, for instance, that if we hit the fiscal cliff, there's going to be federal income tax hikes for everybody. Correct?
Yes.
Okay. we know that there's going to be long-term capital gains. Again, that's taking more money out of the system. And long-term capital gains, you start increasing the it's going to go from 15% to 20%, and then it's going to even go. Rates would soar from 15% to a maximum 39.6% to 43.4% for the wealthiest Americans. That's got to affect investment. How much? And for how long a period of time, I don't really know. Oh, the alternative minimum tax. That's going to affect a lot of people. Payroll taxes. We don't really have the time to go into a lot of these. 1031 like-kind exchanges are not going to be affected by the fiscal cliff. Well, they, unless someone takes action to change some of the benefits from that. That was a question.
I think you're pointing out all the different rates to people. There are, and not only the basic issue becomes, I think, for a lot of people, and in theory, the argument is that if you reduce the returns on investment, if yield on making an investment is lower, you're less inclined to make that investment. And we're doing this now, the potential for us to reduce the return on investment at the level of the entire economy. That would result in lower investment. But the offset to that is that ultimately, if we remain on the path that we're on today, if we continue to build up these deficits, ultimately that means higher taxes down the road, that also discourages it. So we've got to get the fiscal house in order to keep investment going. But it does come back to exactly the point you're making. Then there's this question about, well, what do we tax for it? And that's where a lot of this then comes into play. Coming back to one of our first points, we don't want to tax investment. We see less investment into things that can enhance the long-term performance of the economy. I think there are there are lots of questions about investments in stocks and bonds and to the market. How much does that actually do for actual capacity of the economy? But we know that ultimately we're making trade-offs. There's no way for us to raise revenue or cut spending where there isn't going to be some constituent that must bear some burden from that. And we wanted to get, hopefully it's economically sound, where there is one eye to making the choices in a way that does help the economy perform over the long. My greatest fear right now is that that question, that program or issue around, well, let's do this in a way that really helps to ensure that that people are confident in our economy, are investing in our economy, that our economy is growing, and that it's growth that all Americans. That's really not something we're seeing enough of today.
One of the things that crossed my mind, I know that most people are saying, hey, this is not going to get resolved by the first of the year in terms of a full-scale changes in resolutions, that if anything happens by the first of the year, it's only going to be a real temporary fix, just so that we don't fall over the cliff, so to speak. But over the long term, the expectation is that hopefully we will take care of things. The thought crossed my mind that the compromises and the solutions that we might reach in the next year or 2 years may seem far worse than the fiscal cliff.
True. Think about what I think it's sort of important for us to remember that the fiscal cliff ultimately is sort of our name, an austerity program that where the are not in our immediate control. So we're going to look at this and we'll say, you know, in principle, cutting spending and maybe raising revenue, both of those things are good ideas. Doing it right now and in exactly, you know, doing it across the board cuts, you know, it's the execution on the austerity that is troubling for now. There is the sort of austerity that we're talking about, though, are and the consequences, I think, over the near to me, is falls a little bit short of some of what we see happening in Europe, you know, where you know the cuts to make are much, much deeper, and in some cases are counterproductive. Here we're talking about, you know, a fiscal cliff where, you know, the economy, you know, be frustratingly slow in its recovery and its performance in 2013, or then it begins to find its feet again. But in terms of then, you know, how that compares, you know, what we see happening with our European friends, it's not quite as existential a threat here as it is. And I tell you, there are some folks who are of the opinion that, you know what, we are not, given the current political dynamic, we're not going to be able to get on this question and on this issue of spending. And so perhaps going over the fiscal cliff is as painful as it will be, maybe just the medicine we need. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, that is a sort of the correct about it, but I think what it does reflect is that it's concern, and I think, you know, credible concern that, you know what, we're just not in the current political dynamic be able to solve this problem. And so it gets worse and worse. And so while the fiscal cliff is hardly the ideal way to address this, you know, there are a number of people who believe that it may be the option right now. That unless it's forced on us, we're not going to volition and of our own free will adopt the kind of tough measures that ultimately have to get this thing sorted out.
Yeah. Wow, that's great. Well, Sim, I'd like to thank you very much for spending some time with us. Do you have any speaking engagements coming up soon?
You know, just a quiet month, catching up and you know, doing things a little closer to home. Come January, all starts over. So folks who may be interested can always visit chandan.com, the company's website, chandan.com, or you know, either the company's or my personal Twitter feed. It's just Sam Chandan. And I think, you know, Jack is chock full of engagements, and I'm very much looking forward.
Great. Well, Sam, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. And we're thinking about doing a follow-up show in January or February, and we'd love to have you back on to see if anything has actually happened, which would be a nice
you.
Thing.
Appreciate the invitation, and you know, best wishes to both to you and to all of your listeners and your audience going to the holiday.
Great. You have a happy holidays and a happy new year. And Roger, would you please take us away here? And Sam, I'll contact you actually after the show is done so we can talk briefly, okay?
Thanks.
All right, thank you.
This has been CRE Radio with Howard Klein. If you have a question or a topic you would like to discuss, Howard can be reached at 949-288-3707. That's area 949-288-3707. Or by email to howard@creradio.com. CRE Radio is a live and recorded radio show accessible from both the web and your smartphone. Visit creradio.com to download any broadcast anytime or to receive newsletters and updates from Howard. CRE Radio broadcasts are presented on an informational basis only, with the sole intent of educating our listeners. Howard and his guest conversations specifically do not intend to offer legal advice. If you need legal advice, we recommend you seek out your own counsel. Remember, laws and practices may vary from state to state. Please listen again next time to CRE Radio with Howard Klein. Unauthorized editing or copying of portions of this show without the express written consent of CRE Radio is strictly prohibited. All rights reserved.
And that's a wrap.